So more on transiting planets this afternoon. This is now into the realm of Spitzer, and Heather Knutson from UC Berkeley is going to start it out with a gallery of Spitzer transiting planets. Take it away.
Okay. All right. So since many of you in the room are at least as much of an expert as I am on this, I'm not going to do a lot of introduction. But I thought I would start out by simply making a list of some of the properties of exoplanets we might like to learn. So sort of transitioning from the planet finding part of the talks to the planet characterizing part of the talks. If we want to characterize an extrasolar planet, here are some of the questions we might ask. We'd like to know what the planet's bulk composition is. We get this from its mass and radius measurement, gives us an average density. You've heard a lot about that already today. We can ask what temperature the planet is. We can ask what the composition of its atmosphere is, provided it has one. Not all planets perhaps do. And lastly, we can ask what the circulation on the planet looks like. This is a particularly interesting question for the hot Jupiters, as I'll explain in just a minute. Now, I have ordered this list quite deliberately from what I would say are the easiest things to learn about these planets to what are perhaps the hardest things to learn about the planets. And so in my talk today, I'm going to focus on the latter three items. So these are some of the trickiest measurements to make, and I'll show you examples of why that's the case a little bit later on. But I think we've made good progress on it so far, and so I'll show you some examples of some really exciting measurements, some of them new. Okay. Now, most of the systems that I'm going to talk about today are gas giant planets close in, known as hot Jupiters. They are interesting for a couple of reasons. They're very unusual atmospheres. They're quite hot. They'll have temperatures ranging from typically 1,000 to 2,000, maybe even 2,500 Kelvin. So they're quite warm. That means that their chemistry is going to be quite different than those of the solar system gas giant planets because of the different regime that they're in. We think that these planets are also probably tidally locked. That has interesting consequences for the circulation, which I'll go into a little bit later in my talk. And there's a last reason why hot Jupiters are interesting, which actually has nothing to do with their more unusual properties. It simply has to do with the fact that these are good test cases to study. These are the biggest, brightest, hottest planets that we could possibly look at. And so if we want to ask sort of, you know, how can we test out these new techniques, these are really the planets we want to start with, because it will never be easier to make these measurements than it is for these systems. And everything after that gets harder. Fortunately, we've gotten pretty good at studying hot Jupiters. So I'm going to show you today one of the real challenges right now for hot Jupiters is that we have, you know, we've moved from a point where we're sort of having, you know, we're making the very first observations, we're studying a few systems in exhaustive detail. And so what we're now doing is we're transitioning to a phase in which we're studying the population of hot Jupiters. We see that hot Jupiters have different types of atmospheres, and we're trying to understand the physical processes that lead to that observed diversity in properties. What I'm not going to talk about that much today, but you'll hear more about later, is that you know, now that we've studied these hot Jupiters, that one of the other obvious things to do is to apply these same techniques to smaller and cooler planets. So this is something that's going, you're going to see more and more of over the next couple of years, as these ongoing surveys start to find a greater diversity of planet types for us to study. So how do we actually study the atmospheres of these planets? There's a couple of different techniques we can use. First is the transit. If we measure the wavelength-dependent depth of the transit as the planet goes in front of the star, it tells us something about the transmission spectrum of the planet's atmosphere, so you're seeing absorption features. I'm not going to talk about that today. I think you're going to hear a lot more about that, actually, in the talk immediately following mine. What I am going to talk about today is the second two techniques. I'm going to tell you about secondary eclipse observations and also observations of the orbital phase variations of the planet. The reason that I've chosen to focus on those two techniques in my talk today is that I was asked to speak about Spitzer observations, and I think that Spitzer has really provided some of the best examples of these two phenomena, particularly in the infrared, to date. So what are some of the observations that Spitzer has given us? Going back in time a little bit, the very first secondary eclipse detections came from Spitzer back in 2005. So you can see here's a light curve for HD29458 at 24 microns, and also for Trace 1 at 4.5 and 8 microns. So what you're seeing here is you're seeing the decrease in light as the planet passes behind the star and then reemerges. So here you see the light from the star and the planet together. There you see a dip in light. That's just the light from the star. And then here the planet comes back out. So that difference in light tells you the amount of light contributed by the planet. The really exciting thing about this technique is that it allows us to study the light emitted by extrasolar planets without the need to spatially resolve the planet separate from that of the star. So these are not planets that we are likely to be able to directly image any time in the conceivable future. These are the absolute worst cases for direct imaging. So the fact that we can measure this time-varying signal and learn all of these wonderful details about their atmospheres is actually a really nifty trick. So this is a really good shortcut for studying exoplanet atmospheres with the telescopes that we have available to us today. Now, we can do this same technique, but instead of doing it with photometry, we can also do it with spectra. So here's an example of some IRS spectra. These were both published in 2007. These are looking at HD209458 and HD189733. So here what you're seeing is you take the difference between the out-of-eclipse and the in-eclipse spectrum. So you're measuring an eclipse depth as a function of wavelength. So that tells you not just the emission in one bandpass, it tells you the wavelength-dependent emission of the planet. So now we're talking about emission spectra, talking about spatially resolved information. These spectra, although they're exciting, actually aren't that good. They're kind of noisy. So what I'm going to show you next is the best that we can do. So this now is a compilation of all the available observations on 189733. So you can see there's a couple of different things on this plot. So here I'm just showing you wavelength on the x-axis, planet-star flux ratio on the y-axis. So that's just the eclipse depth we measure. So here in red are the broadband photometry points. So here these were Spitzer IRAC photometry. Out here this is IRS. Out here this is a MIPS observation. Here is the new and upgraded version of the spectrum I showed you on the previous plot. This is a combination of several different eclipse observations with IRS. So that's from Grillmeyer et al. And then even more exciting, there's now a detection at shorter wavelengths. So this is this upper panel up here. It's just expanded. And so this detection is actually from Swain et al. And this is a Nick Moss observation on HST. So for this planet, you can see that we now have data spanning a range of wavelengths and actually with some wavelength resolution. And so I think an interesting question to ask is, given this sort of best case scenario, what can we actually learn about the properties of the planet atmosphere? So the black line that's plotted behind these points is actually a model for the planet. This model is from Mathusudan and Seeger, 2009. And so what they've done in this suite of models is they've allowed the abundances of different common molecules in the atmosphere to vary freely in their fit. So they fit for the abundance of water, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and methane. And they ask how much of each of those they need in order to fit these data. And the other thing that they allow their model to do is they allow it to vary the pressure-temperature profile. So this is how temperature varies with height in the atmosphere. And so with all of those things varying, this is their conclusions, that we can determine the relative abundances of these molecules. The reason they picked these is that these give you the strongest features in the infrared. So these are the best constrained things for this data set. And so what you should take home out of this is that we can determine the relative abundances to sort of plus or minus an order of magnitude in this case. So that's interesting because this allows us to test the assumption that the chemistry in these atmospheres is in thermal equilibrium. There are a lot of things that could take it out of equilibrium. Most of those things are not well predicted by the models, and so this is a good opportunity for us to step in with the data and actually say what we see. In particular, I'm going to highlight this CO2 abundance. This is mainly constrained by the Swain et al. Data. And so this CO2 abundance is actually many orders of magnitude higher than you would expect based on thermal equilibrium alone. The explanation proposed for that in Swain et al. When they reported the discovery is that you have photochemistry in the atmosphere, and that photochemistry is producing extra CO2. So this kind of observation is interesting because it clues us into some of the things. It gives us good observational constraint on what's going on in the planet's atmosphere. Okay. So that's the best we can do for one planet. Let me now show you data on a second planet. So these are now similar kinds of data, although not as numerous, for HD209458. So these are now the Spitzer IRAC secondary eclipse measurements. And here's a MIPS point out here. And so what I'm showing you is sort of the default model that we start with for these planets. This model is a much simpler model now. So it's a 1D radiative transfer model from Burroughs et al., assuming solar composition atmosphere and assuming that it's in local thermal equilibrium. So you consider this as the starting point. And what I'm showing you now on the lower right is I'm showing you the pressure temperature profile for this atmosphere. So you can see as you go higher up in the atmosphere, temperature decreases. What that means is that what you see in the spectrum is you see absorption features. So you're seeing cooler gas overlaying hotter gas. So the absorption features you see are mostly water with a little bit of carbon monoxide in here in this model. And you can tell that this model actually is not a very good match for the data at all. So you might ask, how can we modify this model to provide a better match to the data? Well, one obvious way to do that is we can add something to the atmosphere. If we change the structure of the atmosphere, so we change this feature from an absorption feature into an emission feature, we now make it much brighter here, so we can match the data better. So what we're looking for is a model with water emission. We can do that by adding an extra absorber into the model here in the atmosphere. So you add this extra absorber, it gives you heating in the upper atmosphere. So now you have a temperature inversion. So now as you go higher up in the atmosphere, you hit this layer and you get higher temperatures, water emission, and it's a much better match to the data. So the conclusion that we draw here is that this planet is best described with a temperature inversion. So it's quite different from the properties that we see for 189. So the question is, why do these two different planets have different observed features in their spectrum? So this is sort of independent of the model. If we just look at the spectrum, we see a different shape to the spectrum, and we interpret those differences as one planet having an inversion and another planet not. And this still holds true even for models in which the chemistry is allowed to vary. So if you relax the assumptions of the model a bit, it's still best fit by a model with a temperature inversion. So if we see some planets, I have one more point to mention here. So I'll tell you more about this later in my talk, but warm Spitzer, so Spitzer in the past was able to observe out to fairly long wavelengths. Now it's run out of cryogen, so it only works at the shorter wavelengths, so we're limited to observing in 3.6 and 4.5 microns. But it turns out that these two types of planets have a very distinct signature in those two band passes. So I'm going to tell you later a little bit about some of the new observations we're making. I'm going to extrapolate based on those two data points whether or not these planets have an inversion. Okay, but first, just sticking with the data we already have. So if we want to come up with a theory for what causes these temperature inversions, one plausible candidate might be gas phase titanium oxide. That's a good candidate absorber because it is a very effective absorber in the redder part of visible light. So you want something that traps a lot of the incident flux. These are mostly sun-like stars. We also see it in cooler stellar atmospheres, so it's very plausible this could be in these atmospheres. They're about the right temperature. So if it's gas phase titanium oxide, what we expect to be going on here is we expect 294.58 is just hot enough that this stuff is in gas phase. It gives you some extra absorption. You create inversion. These planets are a little bit too cool. So in these atmospheres, the titanium oxide would have condensed out. So this gives us a really simple testable hypothesis, which is that anything above some temperature should be hot enough to have gas phase titanium oxide, and anything below that, it should have condensed out. So we should only see temperature inversions for planets that are above this region here. So 2008, we now have a couple more systems. I can throw those up on the plot. And the theory has a problem. And that problem is X01. So X01 is almost exactly the same incident flux as 189, and yet we see X01 has a temperature inversion, while 189 does not. So that doesn't really fit very well with the titanium oxide picture. Now, if we add a couple more systems, we see we have another problem for our theory, and that problem is trace 3. Trace 3 is hot enough that it should definitely have this compound, but it doesn't. So now we have sort of exceptions on both ends, and so this theory is starting to look a little bit shakier. So it would seem like a good time to look for some alternative hypothesis, and there's a couple that we can come up with. One is that you might have some sort of non-equilibrium chemistry. In particular, there's a paper by Zonley et al. Which proposed you could have sulfur compounds, which would give you similar kind of absorption. And there's sort of also another parallel theory to that, which is that you could have photochemistry in the upper atmosphere, giving you some similar compound, which might serve the same purpose. And so as an observer, I look at this and I wonder, okay, well, how can we actually test these theories? Well, if you like the photochemistry theory, maybe what I should be plotting on this axis is not incident bolometric flux. Maybe what really matters is the UV flux received by the planets. Well, how can we measure the UV flux? It just so happens that having recently moved to Berkeley, I discovered that there is a wonderful database of high-resolution spectra for many of the transiting planet host stars obtained with high-res. And that database allows me to measure the calcium H and K emission, which says something about the activity of the star and presumably the UV flux. So here what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you for all of the transiting planet host stars that are currently have been observed by Keck high-res. I'm going to show you the stellar effective temperature and also the calcium H and K emission index. So more active stars are going to be higher up and more quiet stars are going to be farther down. So these are all of the systems that we have right now. So this is a paper that we're working on right now. And so I've plotted the non-inverted systems as blue stars and the inverted systems as red circles. And so you can see immediately that the three most active stars in this set are the stars with planets without temperature inversions. So that seems to suggest that perhaps UV flux really is an important factor in determining the properties of the emission spectra that we see. So maybe there is some sort of photochemistry going on. In this case, I would speculate that perhaps what's going on is that the increased UV flux is actually destroying something that's responsible for the temperature inversions, because you need some sort of theory in which extra UV flux gets rid of the inversion. But I think that's an open question for debate. Okay. This is an interesting correlation, but it's not very secure. And it's not very secure because there are not many systems on this plot. So if we really want to test this theory, what we really would like to do is go out and get observations of a bunch of additional systems and see if this correlation holds up. So this is something that's ongoing right now as part of the Warm Spitzer mission. There's a number of programs. Myself and others are going to observe 20 to 30 additional systems over the next 2 years. And we're going to use these systems to test out this theory and see if it holds up. So just to tell you a little bit more about the WARM mission. So for 5.5 years, Spitzer was cryogenically cooled. So it observed at 3.6 out to actually longer than 24 microns. But for exoplanet purposes, we'll call it 24. And so during that time, I'm just showing you the number of hours that Spitzer allocated in each cycle to exoplanet observations. And the reason I'm showing you this is that I wanted to highlight a point, which is that last summer, Spitzer exhausted the last of its cryogen. After that, we're limited to observing in the 3.6 and 4.5 micron channels. But the benefit to that is that there's now a lot more time available, because all of those other groups that were using the long wavelength channels can't use it anymore. So if you can do something interesting with those channels, you can get a lot of time. And so sure enough, in the WARM mission, Spitzer has allocated a substantial amount of time to exoplanet observations. And that's very exciting, because that allows us to survey significantly greater number of systems. So this allows us to really look at hot Jupiters as a population instead of looking at individual systems. And it's that kind of comparative analysis that's really going to tell us what's going on in these atmospheres. So made that point. Okay, so here's actually some new data from the WARM mission. So this is very recent. We just started taking data in October for my program. And so this is some of the very first light curves. Actually, two of these are from Dave Charbonneau's program. It's a program to follow up Kepler systems. And these others are my hot Jupiter program. But anyway, this is the very first data that we've gotten. So what I'm showing you on the left is actually the raw photometry from this program. So this is analysis has been done by Drake Deming and Jean-Michel Desert. It's being written up right now. So what we see in these channels is we see that there's a well-known effect called the intrapixel effect, which is that the sensitivity of an individual pixel varies from the center out to the edge. So as the star, so there's a very small pointing oscillation in the telescope. So Spitzer oscillates up and down on timescales of about an hour. And as it oscillates back and forth, it moves back and forth across the pixel. And we see that the flux we measure varies in time. So initially, that looks to be pretty problematic, because it's very hard to pick out the eclipse, secondary eclipse by eye in most of these plots. Fortunately, there's a very simple way to remove this effect, which is simply if we fit these light curves with a function of the x and y position of the star and divide that fit out. So the red is our best fit to this effect. We divide that out, and we get the plot on the right. And you see we can clearly see some nice secondary eclipse light curves. So the other point I wanted to make is that we're now looking at a much broader range of systems than we were before. So a lot of the data I showed you was for HD 189. That is fifth magnitude in K-band. These stars are 10th to 12th magnitude in K-band. So these are much more typical of most of the stars that Spitzer will be looking at during the WARM mission and secondary eclipse. So these are much fainter. But we're still able to get, in most cases, good, clear detections of the secondary eclipse. So this is still a very doable brightness range to work in. So I think that's a good sign. For those of you interested in sort of more details of the performance of WARM Spitzer, I'll just say one more thing, which is that the only difference that we've noticed so far between the cold mission and the WARM mission data is that the size of this sensitivity variation appears to be a bit larger in the WARM mission data. So the effects that we're taking out are a factor of a few larger than before, but they still seem to be relatively well behaved. OK. So Right, so the second part of my talk, I told you I would say a little bit about phase curves. So what we're looking at here is you're measuring the changes in the brightness of the planet as it goes around the star. What do we get out of that? So as I mentioned, we think that close-in extrasolar planets should be tidally locked. That's just a timescale argument. If we compare the timescale for them to be tidally locked versus the age of the system, that timescale is usually much shorter. So if they are tidally locked, that means all of the incident flux is received on one half of the planet. And so it's possible that some of these planets have very large temperature gradients between the day side and the night side, and that as a consequence of that, they may also have large chemical gradients between the two hemispheres, depending on what the circulation does. One other consequence of that, if they're tidally locked, their rotation period is the same as their orbital period. So unlike Jupiter, which rotates approximately once every 10 hours, these planets rotate more on the order of several days. So they're much more slowly rotating than what we're used to thinking of for the solar system. So the consequence of that slow rotation is that it means that features in their atmosphere get to be larger. So here's a comparison. This is an image of Jupiter taken at 5 microns. And this is a circulation model for HD 80606 from Laughlin et al. So just as sort of a basic scale argument, Jupiter has these very narrow banded structures. And vortices are generally quite small. In these atmospheres, we expect that they would have several broad bands, much wider, and that vortices could also be correspondingly larger. So weather on these planets is global in scale. The things we're looking for are actually quite large, which is good, because their resolution isn't very small. So the easiest things for us to detect are these big features. So here's an example of some phase curve data. This is a phase curve for HD 189, again, the best system that we could study. Observed at 8 microns with Spitzer. So we start out just before the transit when we're viewing the night side of the planet. We watch over half an orbit as the day side comes around into view. So there you see the secondary eclipse, and then we stop observing just a little bit after. So the reason I wanted to show you this plot is I said I would explain why I put phase curves at the very bottom of my list as the hardest thing to measure. So transits of a few percent we can do from the ground for this kind of star quite easily. Secondary eclipses are mostly done with Spitzer, but also starting to be done from the ground. I think one of the most exciting things this year and the publication of a number of ground-based secondary eclipse detections in the infrared. But what we're looking for here is we're looking for a variation that's smaller than the secondary eclipse by a factor of 5, probably. And the time scale for that variation, instead of being a couple of hours, is now something like 30 hours. So that's really the kind of observation that's best done from space. And in particular, Spitzer is very well suited to that kind of observation because it's in an Earth-trailing orbit. So we can stare at the same object continuously for long periods of time in very stable conditions. And so we can look for these very slowly varying signals. OK, so what do we actually get out of this phase curve? So here is just the same plot I showed you before, except in the lower panel, I've expanded the y-axis so you can see better what's going on in between the transit and the secondary eclipse. I've also normalized the data during secondary eclipse to 1, because this is when the planet is behind the star. So this tells you how much light is contributed by the star. Anything above this is light contributed by the planet. So the depth of this secondary eclipse tells you the amount of light from the day side. And the slope of this phase curve tells you the day-night brightness difference. So here you can see the night side is probably about 2/3 the brightness of the day side. So if I make the very simplistic assumption that the planet's a black body, that would correspond to a night side of 1,000 Kelvin and a day side of 1,200 Kelvin. So day-night temperature gradient of about 200 Kelvin, relatively small. Predictions were that it could be much, much larger if you had relatively weak circulation between the two hemispheres. We can also do better than that. There's more information in this phase curve than just the amplitude, which is what I was using before. We can look at where the minimum is, where the maximum is, and we can look at the shape of this rise in flux. The way we do that is we fit this phase curve with an orange slice model for the planet. So we have longitudinal slices of constant brightness, in this case 12, and we ask what the flux in each slice needs to be in order to match this phase curve. So here you can see that the hottest part of the planet is shifted to the east of the substellar point, and that the coldest part of the planet is shifted west in this case. So I'm not going to say too much more about that, except to say that we can then compare these observations to general circulation models for these atmospheres. So these kinds of observations let us actually both sort of observationally say something about the circulation, but also give us a good sort of back and forth where as we add more data, they get better constraints on the circulation models. Circulation models improve, we go back to the data. And so I think there's a very interesting back and forth discussion going on between these two efforts. So I said I would show some new data. So here is a new 24 micron phase curve for 29458. So here, for comparison, I plotted the 24 micron light curve for HD189. And again, you can see that we see the same thing at 24 microns we do at 8, which is, here's the secondary eclipse. You see the night side really is almost as bright as the day side, so very small brightness difference. So here is our light curve for HD29458. And again, this is half an orbit. So here's the transit. There's the secondary eclipse. And so one obvious feature in this light curve, there's a big ramp at the beginning. That was a surprise. We didn't see that at all in these data. I'm happy to talk about that more later. The short answer is that we think that this is an effect analogous to the ramp that we see in the 8-micron channel. We think the reason we don't always see it, in fact, we rarely see something like this, is that often Spitzer is observing very bright things at 24 microns, so that we may be effectively saturating out this ramp in most of our data. But this time we happen to have bad luck, and what was observed before us was probably something pretty faint. So we create this ramp. The take-home point, though, is that this data is pretty reliable, and you can see it's quite flat. So here's the secondary eclipse. So the take-home point here is that these two planets are very similar, that both of them have relatively small day-night brightness gradients. So they have probably relatively similar circulation patterns. Now, taking a step back, let's look at all of the data that we have on phase curves for hot Jupiters. There's some evidence that there may be a diversity of circulation patterns, similar to the diversity of emission spectra we see. So the two planets that I showed you fall into this category of having small brightness gradients between the day side and the night side. In the middle here, there's one planet which seems to have an intermediate gradient, HD149026. This is a hot Saturn with a large core, perhaps a metal-enriched atmosphere, probably a little bit different. And then here on the large gradient side, observations of a couple systems. There's Upsilon Andromeda, HD179949. Neither of those are transiting, so there's some degeneracies in our interpretation of the phase curve, depending on what we assume for the planet's radius and the inclination. And lastly, there's HAT-P7, which doesn't have Spitzer data yet, although it will, but has a lovely Kepler light curve. And it happens that HAT-7 is hot enough that a good part of what we see in this bandpass probably is thermal emission. So the fact that it sees a large phase variation probably tells us that the night side is quite cool, relatively speaking. So the question with these is, why do we see these different behaviors? And I think we really have no idea what the important differences are. We're just starting to see that there are differences at all. So I think one interesting thing over the next couple of years will be, as we add more systems to this sample, if we can discern any patterns, what are some of the important properties of the systems? Does metallicity matter for the circulation? Does the incident flux or the very hottest systems have different behaviors than the cooler systems? I think all of that will start to emerge over the next couple of years. I should mention one other interesting kind of observation we can make. All of the planets I showed you before have basically circular orbits. We can go to sort of an opposite extreme and look at planets with very eccentric orbits. This is 80606, which you heard about earlier. So this is a observation at 8 microns with Spitzer during periastron passage for the planet. So this is as it's coming in. So this is at its hottest point in the orbit. So what you're seeing is the atmosphere is flash heated during this close passage. So you see the bump in flux, and then you see the drop off as it starts to cool. One exciting thing that came out of this observation is that this planet was not known to transit before this data was obtained. But serendipitously, they discovered that there was a secondary eclipse in their data. Subsequent follow-up observations showed that this planet also transited. So this is now the longest period transiting planet system we know of. It has a period of about 111 days. So Spitzer is going to make similar observations of other highly eccentric planets, including HAT-P2, HD17156, and XO3, over the next year or two during the warm mission. So you're going to see more observations like this, but with better coverage. OK, one other thing we should be doing with these phase curves, I've been showing you everything and sort of taking one bandpass, treating the planet like a black body, and extrapolating from there to the temperature field, which, from what I showed you earlier, is clearly not at all the right assumption to make. We know these planets are very much not black bodies. So what we really need to do to treat the circulation more accurately is to obtain phase curves at multiple wavelengths and to ask how the emission spectrum of the planet changes as a function of orbital phase or as a function of longitude on the planet, you could think of it. So during the cryogenic mission, we did this at 8 and 24 microns. So one thing we're doing during the warm mission is we're now reobserving the same systems at shorter wavelengths at 3.6 and 4.5. That's interesting because those are much closer to the peak of the planet's emissions. So if you want to talk about making an energy budget for the planet, those are the wavelengths that you want to look at to constrain its thermal emission. And they also might tell us something about the horizontal extent of the temperature inversions in the planet's atmosphere. So we can ask if there are features in the spectrum that change between the day side and the night side. Right. So as my very last point, I just wanted to say that there's one other really exciting opportunity that's come up as a result of the Kepler and Corot missions. Not only are these missions wonderful facilities for finding new planets, they actually tell us a lot of interesting things about known planets, or even the planets that they find and we follow up, which is there have now been a couple of observations of secondary eclipses and phase curves in visible light from these telescopes published. So I'm thinking of Corot 1 and also HAT-P7 and Corot 2 for the secondary eclipse. So what you're going to see in the future is you're going to see people starting to combine these observations with infrared observations from Spitzer and also perhaps from the ground. And the combination of those two can be very powerful. It might actually tell us something for the first time about the albedos of those planets. If you can measure the reflected light component in visible and look at what the thermal emission is in the infrared, you can actually then take the difference of those two and figure out what the actual albedo of the planet is, which would be something that would be very new. We haven't had good observational constraints on albedos so far. Okay, and yeah, there's going to be some ground-based data for that as well. Okay. So with that, I'm going to leave you with my conclusion slide, just to sort of reiterate a bit. I think that really the big change in terms of how we think about hot Jupiters is that we're really thinking about hot Jupiters as a population. We're comparing different types of planets. We're asking how common or rare different properties are, so different types of emission spectra, different types of circulation. And those differences are starting to tell us something about the actual physics that's going on in these atmospheres. So we're actually getting to do real planetary science, real atmospheric science with these planets. And that's a really exciting thing. And that in the future, we're going to start applying these same techniques to smaller and cooler planets. And that's coming very soon. So thanks.
OK, thank you, Heather. So let's go with the first question here, please. Get some lights.
So I have two questions. The first one is, how does your 24 micron secondary eclipse point for 2.94 compare with the previous observation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've reanalyzed the old archival data and compared that with my new secondary eclipse. And so I have three independent measurements of the secondary eclipse step. Mm-hmm. And it looks like they're all consistent. The two unpublished values are coming in a bit higher than the one published in Deming et al. But if you look at the error bars, they're all self-consistent. So the average is going to be a bit higher. About 0.3%. Yeah.
So the second question is, in the past, thermal inversions or the reasons behind it of TIOVO have been correlated with the day-night circulation, like the amount of day-night circulation you would expect if you had an absorber causing a thermal inversion.
Ah, okay. So right. You're talking about the idea that if you have a high altitude absorber, right, you trap more heat higher up, and so it's harder to get that around to the night side. So you would expect perhaps to see larger day-night variations for those.
But now you see that for 209 and for 189, you see the same sort of phase curve.
Yes, so, right. So I think that's a definitive answer to that question, at least for those two planets, is that even though they have different day-side emission spectra, that we see the same circulation. Mm-hmm. And this is also consistent with what comes out of, so what I was referring to before is sort of a back of the envelope picture of the circulation. More detailed models for those two planets, so I'm thinking of the Shoman models, actually say that they should have both pretty warm night sides. Okay. So that all hangs together.
Thanks.
Okay, next question, Bill.
Rookie. I'd like to ask about the possibility that we have a giant planet close to a star. The star is distorted, so that just before occultation occurs, you see a minimization of the star because it's sort of football shaped and pointed at you.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly for HAT-P7, we see that effect.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that since some of these signals seem to be even larger than what we saw by a factor of 300, that you would begin to pick that up as well.
Right. Yeah, I think it's something definitely to consider because those two kinds of signals are not that different. And so you could ask it both ways. You could ask for the Kepler data, could any of the observed variation, or how much of that part of the signal, like if you just had a slightly different temperature field on the planet, could you affect your estimate of the size of that effect. And correspondingly, in the infrared, where most of what you see is from the planet, could some fraction of that also be from this effect in the star? And I think that's something that we haven't thought much about. The nice thing about having Kepler data is that you actually have the precision that you can do this kind of work. So I think it's very interesting to see what was, yeah, right. But we learn from both.
Okay, from the blackboard.
Yeah, there had been a comment this morning about the lack of predictions from theoreticians in this field. I'd like to point out that both the day to night temperature difference and also the asymmetry of the light curve was predicted 5 years before the actual observation. Ah. And that's also a bit the case of the for the temperature inversion. So
right. So in the case of the phase curves, I think we suffered from an overabundance of predictions, as I recall. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So.
Any more on that?
Right. So the models that I recall said kind of gave a range of temperatures. And so what we actually measured for 189 came in sort of on one end of that range. So we can talk more about specific models. But
hi. Yeah. You showed us a map of the hotspot. And that's from the phase curves. And mm-hmm. as you say, you think of that as a function of longitude. But it also has latitudinal structure. Where does that come from?
That is an extrapolation. I made a sine function going to the poles. So I wanted to do a map projection, something a little bit more 2D. Let me pull it up. But yeah, the only information we get from the phase curve is the dependence on longitude. So all I've done is taken that longitudinal profile. Yep, there we go, the thing on the bottom, and I've added a sine function in latitude.
Hi, I'm Matt Umerhan. I just wanted to point out with relation to the predictions, of course, as probably a lot of people know, the many of the models show that the circulation patterns are not steady, and there's a lot of debate on this matter as well. So one of the things that seemed to be sensible is to take one of these objects and then do a series of repeated eclipse measurements, we're talking hundreds of days, mm-hmm. to see for variation of that. I know it's a little ambitious, but it would be something sensible to do to help also pin down a lot of these issues that are coming up from the modeling side of matters as well. For instance, like the phasing, mm-hmm. for instance, that hot spot might move.
Yes, yes.
As a number of calculations show. So.
Right. This is something that people have certainly thought about. There are two sets of data that I can think of that are doing exactly that experiment. One, I think, is now a submitted paper, which is that Eric Agle has six secondary eclipse measurements of 189, which, when combined with the phase curve, have a time span of about 6 months between them. And so that's not quite the time sampling you were suggesting, but it's a start. And their conclusion is that they see that things are constant to a level of about 10%. So some of the models that I've seen predict variations more like a few percent. We're not sensitive to those yet. There's also a second data set, which is not published, on GJ436, Greg Laughlin, with sort of a similar idea. In that case, the planet's eccentric. And you might think that the eccentric orbit could give you more variability.
You think there might be any hope to convince telescope allocation committee to take on such a thing? I'm just putting that out there in general for anyone who might have some influence in the matter.
I think the trick with those is, because it's so time intensive, you really want to pick your systems carefully. So if you had a system where you had good reason to think that that would be the case, that would be a much stronger argument for lavishing time on that system.
Heather, thank you for the talk. Diana Valencia, from an untrained eye, I see that the data that you showed for the secondary transit of, for example, HadP5 or others, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to pick out a secondary transit there at all. I see just scatters. So how can you convince me that there is a secondary transit there?
So that's partially a function of bin size and axis scale. So certainly some of these are very clear and others are not. That's true. So you might look at the Kepler planets and say, well, that looks a little bit less clear. We're still working on these data. These are very preliminary data. So I think we're going to improve the photometry on those. And it's probably going to end up being something like a 5-sigma detection. So it's not going to be a 60-sigma detection like we had for 189. But yeah, I think it's definitely there. I think we definitely see it in the data.
Okay, so Andrew and then Nick.
So this is a question, I guess, both for you and maybe a discussion for the modelers. And I guess the question is, how robustly, especially from a couple of photometric points, can you interpret the observations as a definitive sign of a thermal inversion? And what are maybe future observations to better nail down the TP profiles?
So we always benefit from better wavelength resolution. The hardest or the most ambiguous data to interpret are the Spitzer-IRAC photometry because it's such a broad bandpass. So having the HST observations is very helpful. Having the IRS observations was also helpful, although we've gotten all we will get for those. This is an example of, so this is saying, could we model 209458? And this is from Madhusudan and Seeger. So could we model 209458 without a temperature inversion just by varying the chemistry? So that's, I think, the kind of question you were getting at. And so the conclusion in this case is you can come up with a model that does decently well fit those points, but that model has kind of a weird chemistry. You have to reduce the amount of CO and at the same time increase the amount of methane, which you wouldn't expect at those temperatures. And more than that, you might say, oh, we'll just reduce the oxygen abundance a bit, and that'll reduce the CO. But you also, at the same time that you need more methane, need more water and more carbon dioxide. And that's kind of hard to put together in a coherent picture. So I think a temperature inversion is a much simpler explanation. So it kind of makes more sense to go with that. We see temperature inversions all the time in the solar system planets. So that's a very easy thing to make compared to coming up with a scenario that would explain that kind of chemistry.
Okay, Nick.
So I want to address a question from you. So Heather was actually a bit pessimistic about how awesome our results are. I have a poster outside. So my name is Nick Cowan. I have a poster outside about this. And those secondary eclipse measurements that we did for 189733 are actually only vary at the 2.7% level over a 2-year baseline, and they don't show any time structure. And not only that, but when you stack them together, they're actually sufficiently good to do secondary eclipse mapping of the planet, which actually exactly confirms where the hotspot is on the day side. So it exactly confirms the maps that we've made from phase variation. So it actually is giving a very consistent picture, and it looks like the weather is not changing at the level of 2.7%.
Yeah, so I definitely encourage you guys to all look at that poster because that's an awesome data set.
Yeah, just a quick question which comes to my mind right now. I mean, I think it's your idea that temperature inversion, I mean, there is a relationship between the, let's say, the X-ray activity of the parent star and the fact that you do get or don't get temperature inversion because you get an X-ray photodissociation of TIO for the active stars. Mm-hmm. And we heard this morning that, and we know that most of the M dwarfs are very active. So if I follow you up on this kind of suggestion, you will never expect having any temperature inversion on exoplanets orbiting M star. M stars, right?
So I should.
Or do I go a little bit too far on the?
Right. So I would qualify that with the statement: there are lots of different ways to make temperature inversion. So especially as you move into different temperature regimes in the planet's atmosphere, and I'm thinking of GJ-436 here, that your starting material is quite different. So you might have a totally different mechanism for forming an inversion. But for something of the analogous, a hot Jupiter of that temperature around an M dwarf with a high UV flux, then this theory would say no inversion. I also forgot to mention here that for 209458, we actually have more data than what I'm showing here. There's actually Nick Moss secondary eclipse data that's this analogous to what I showed you for 189. And fitting that data with a similar kind of model where abundances vary, the conclusion is also that it really is best fit by a temperature inversion. So that seems to be holding up pretty well.
Heather, I'm Dave Spiegel. I thought it was a really interesting correlation that you had with the UV flux and the presence or absence of an inversion. Just wanted to point out that there's reason on theoretical grounds to think that TIO might not be responsible for the inversions as well, which is that if you have an inversion, by definition, the deeper atmosphere is somewhat cooler, and that could create a cold trap that might cause titanium oxide that would have been present in the absence of the cold trap
to rain out down below. So it would require a lot of macroscopic mixing to get the TIO up into the hot region where it could create the thermal inversion.
Yeah, and in fact, I would even generalize that statement a bit to say that it's really almost a little bit hard to believe that these planets should at all have their chemistry and match what you would predict from thermal equilibrium, because if you have these temperature variations and you have mixing between different layers of the atmosphere, that you're shifting material around between different parts of the atmosphere, and so you could easily have sources and sinks for different materials, and so what you see might not at all be in thermal equilibrium, the chemistry that you see.
Okay, last question.
Hi, there's James Cho. Have you considered non-chemical abundance origin of the inversion layer, like dynamical origins?
Yeah, right. So if you,
I don't mean just
to...
the flows, but there's a nice poster out by Watkins and Cho.
Yeah. Right.
On temperature inversion due to waves.
Yeah, so I think that's the case where I would say, show me the model that proves that you can get the right size of temperature inversion in the right location for it. And yeah, cool, we can go with that.
Okay, our convener wants the last question.
Yeah.
Just very quickly, some of these objects require temperature differences that are more than 1,000 Kelvin to give you the inversion. Usually dynamical effects can give you a few hundred most, but 1,000 or 1,500 Kelvin might be hard if it's not by absorptions. A place where I don't think you can do it, but let's talk after the fact. After.
Okay, thank you very much, Heather. So we're going to continue the story of spectroscopy with Spitzer and modeling of that, with Giovanna Tanetti from University College London.